Thank you all for joining us. This session is going to feel a little bit to you like a cross between a cocktail party. As you see here we all are, clinking, yes, which works for those of us from the East Coast. I flew in from Boston, so it actually is almost happy hour time right now. This is water, just to clarify for everybody in the room. It will be part cocktail party and part revolving door, because if you've ever done a standing meeting instead of a sitting meeting, you know that's what it's for. We're going to move this along really fast because we have a lot to cover, and we're going to do a lot of it sort of all at once. Basically, this whole agenda we've mushed together, and we're going to do it in a sort of consolidated way that makes a couple of big points and then fills in some flesh around those points. Here's the flesh right here, in the form of our two NGLC grantees who are joining us here today, both engaged in breakthrough learning and program initiative design, and encountering all of the challenges that you too will encounter or already are if you're engaged in doing it a truly comprehensive approach to designing and implementing next generation learning. We're going to start with just a 30-second run through of the NGLC initiative. Apologies to those of you who already know us really well and for whom this will be the third or tenth time you've heard this. But in a really fast nutshell, NGLC was born out of the Gates Foundation about 2.5 years ago. The basic idea was to inject money into the system of innovation, put grants from about $100,000 to about $2 million into the hands of the people doing the most imaginative work in rethinking models around a set of core principles: personalized, blended, competency-based learning at affordable prices, at both the K-12 level and in the post-secondary level. Ever since, we and our partners, who are the organizations you see listed here, have been working to produce outcomes along the lines of these three strategies. We've invested about $40 million or so in the last 2 years in these innovators and institutions. We've been working like crazy to try to figure out how to help those innovators learn from each other and how to extract information from them for the benefit of the whole field. And we're this year going to be launching some initiatives that are intentionally organized to accelerate the adoption of some of the strategies that are being pioneered by our grantees. Here's a national map of all 75 or so NGLC grantees. You can see we're starting to fill in. We don't have one in every state, but we're practically getting there, including a couple here in Colorado. And this is one of the things that we're learning. This slightly complicated triangle, it is reminiscent of M.C. Escher, and that was intentional. So don't look at it too hard or you'll get a headache trying to figure out exactly where you are inside the triangle. But this is what we're learning from our grantees, that you can't do next generation breakthrough learning design and only take on, you know, one side of the elephant. You got to take on the whole elephant at once. And even if your project isn't taking on the whole elephant at once, all of the various dimensions of next generation learning are going to come to the fore when you're designing an initiative like that. And so this is a sort of summary graphic that pulls together the six dimensions of next generation learning that we think so far, and this is all a work in progress, reflects what is starting to come out of our grantee experience and their emerging student outcomes. The framework is divided into three domains, let's call them goals, methods, and environments. Nothing in this framework is earth-shattering in and of itself, although you'll see that there are some points of view expressed sort of all the way through it. Within each of the domains, there are two dimensions. And in within the goals domain, we're saying there's a big piece of work that is about really being clear about our definition of outcomes. And almost all of our grantees are engaged actively in that kind of work at both the K-12 and the post-secondary levels in different ways. And the other big part of the goals domain is knowing how to measure for those richer, deeper definitions of student success. The second domain is the whole area called methods. That consists of designing and implementing. And here's where you see the hypotheses that rest at the base of NGLC creeping in. We're saying the kinds of learning that we're trying to help foster here are the ones that are getting at an approach to education that is much more deeply personalized than what has been the norm student experience, again, in both sectors, that it is competency-based, it's active and inquiry-based, it's collaborative, and it uses online and blended environments. And under implement, the assumption there is that in order to produce a learning model that incorporates all of those kinds of elements, you've really got to implement in many different ways. You've got to create different roles for people. You've got to create different budgets. Everything in the ways that you use and allocate time, resources, place, money, scheduling, HR, are all going to change in the course of designing and implementing those kinds of programs. And then the last domain is environments. And this is the sort of, this is the water that we're swimming in. And the fishbowl part of the water is what you need, what they need, in order to make their pilots work so that there isn't something in place, either regulatorily or legislatively or internal politics-wise or economically, that stands in the way of their even trying the experiment. That's the enable part. And then the scale part is what happens after that. And that involves a set of elements that we've summarized here. And you can go to the paper that introduces this framework, which is on both the NGLC site, nextgenlearning.org, and at the EDUCAUSE site. Just search for six dimensions of next generation learning, or a framework for next generation learning, and you'll find it. And you'll also, over time, start to see what you're going to hear live today, examples of how institutions like yours are trying to push the edge of the envelope and try to put these kinds of ideas into practice. So that brings us to the first domain, and now what we're going to do is start our rotation and our revolving door. Nancy's going to kick it off by doing a few themes that we're seeing across the whole grantee pool, and then we'll hand it over to Allison and Art after that. Okay.
Thanks. Given that our first speaker invoked the sacred city of New York, I thought you might like to be reminded of what Yogi Berra said on the subject of outcomes, which was, you've got to be very careful if you don't know where you're going, because you might not get there. So in the spirit of outcomes, We do have, as Andy mentioned, very large number of grantees who are out there who thought very carefully about outcomes before they started their work and who are tracking those outcomes as they move through what they're doing. Our most recent wave of grant making in higher education sought a very specific set of outcomes, both in terms of prices, in terms of percentages of students who would complete, in terms of the methods that would be used in these brand new degree programs in higher education. We have 10 groups of grantees working on those breakthrough models today, and we have two represented here. And in showing how the framework applies, I'm going to be drawing largely on those models and the outcomes that they define, both for students and for the institution. So there were a large number of goals that apply across the NGLC programs, and a large amount of our attention is given to the way in which outcomes are defined and measured. One of the things that the grantees, particularly in our 3B programs, are doing is working with employers to ascertain the skills and outcomes that are most needed. For instance, the Texas Affordable Baccalaureate Program is working with employers in councils to look very specifically at what the employers would like to see from the graduates of these programs, and they're building that into the programs as they're about to be launched in this coming September. The grantees are also incorporating into the curriculum ways in which students will do more than take tests to show what they've learned. So at Southern New Hampshire University, the learning is broken in the two-year program is broken into 120 competencies, and each of those students demonstrate mastery of the competency not by taking a test but by engaging a project, which is then evaluated according to a specific rubric by independent evaluators as the student moves through those competencies. As I mentioned a minute ago, we have two of the 3B model developers with us today, and I'm delighted to introduce them. Their names were given before, but ArtCV is with the University System of Georgia, and the breakthrough model there is for an accelerated service learning-based bachelor's degree model for college completion that's being put into place with Columbus State University as the partner campus. Allison is with Northern Arizona University, where the breakthrough model is called the Personalized Learning Division. And they're going to be sharing with you the ways in which they have used these framework components of defining and measuring in designing their programs. Allison.
I'll start with goals. And the goal that I want to talk about with you today is deeper learning. And one of the things that we wanted to do with our degree paths, and we have three majors that work through that degree path, is to make sure that student learning was deep, and that is that they would retain it, but also that we would bring back to education, especially for adult learners, joy and fun. And so we thought if we can bring back the joy and bring back the fun of learning, then students will retain things better and learners will be able to become what our goal for them is to become autodidact. And so what we did was we respected the student as they came to us, and hence part of the personalized learning. And so the student comes to us and they know how to do a lot of things. They have a large body of knowledge, and they also have some college and other kinds of credit. And so we don't just take that on word. We don't have them do a long portfolio system. They come to us with what they know, enter our degree path, and then they can start wherever they want. And we can ascertain, because of the way that we built the system, what they know because of what they can do. And so we think that there won't be a student in our system that is sitting waiting for something to finish that they already know, and they can start where it's exciting for them. And another thing that we did that we're really excited about is we thought, why do we bind ourselves to credit hours? Why do we bind ourselves to courses? Let's take the courses and look at what the learning outcomes are and how important those are to us. And then we took the learning outcomes and reassembled them in ways that make sense for the way that students might actually want to learn and how it might profit them in the workplace. And of course, we had conversations with people who hire. And so a student won't take an economics course, but will have an economics outcome combined with a learning outcome from literature, combined with a learning outcome from language. And so those are just a few of the things that we've done to meet the goal of deeper learning. It's just to continuously ask ourselves, we don't have to do it the old way. What's the way that we can create an autodidact who's able to adapt to the environment that they find themselves in?
So we're still at sort of the early stages, and definitely in the definitional phase. But when we first saw this opportunity, actually, I think the internal discussion we had is important to understand, because there's this term out there for of a completion degree. And I work on college completion and policy around that. and all for college completion, but I think the term completion degree is not necessarily what we're talking about here, and a potentially dangerous term in that sense, that if we're really looking at what NextGen is looking at in terms of new models and really what the students should be learning, you know, we'll be back and ask our question, what's maybe not the path of least resistance, but what do we ourselves really think the students should be learning? And we went to Columbus State and asked them about that. Interestingly, you know, they came back with us and said, we really want focus on straight out of high school, low income, especially given the background in Georgia, the particularly underprepared coming out of our high schools. And that means a big, big challenge. And the area of focus that the faculty actually came back with was communications. So we have a bachelor's of art in communication with a civic leadership focus. And when they initially came back with that, I was kind of like, huh, okay, how's this going to work? What are we really going to do with that? And then we start looking at things like Lumino's degree qualifications profile, looking at what AACNU is doing with LEAP and understanding what employers' needs are out there. And communication, I didn't touch anything, I promise. Communication really is one of those frequently cited skills and areas that graduates come out without and are high demand. And if we think about what Diana said this morning about the connected age, really that's what our program is about, is communication in a connected age and all the skills that will be applicable delivered through that. Do you want me to keep going while we're waiting? Sure. All right. And then civic leadership also. Columbus State University has a strong history in working with a network of employers and nonprofits, government agencies, local organizations. So it's a communication degree. But embedded throughout the courses are going to be actual in-person experiences. Even though the 100% delivery is online, there's still going to be expectations that they go and work in the community in which they're located. So the students gain those real-world experiences and create connections, applying what they're learning with faculty online.
Good. Thank you. So at the end of each of these little mini chapters, as we conclude each domain of this framework, we'll ask if there are any just real fast clarifying questions you want to ask of either of our grantees about something they've just said, whether it has to do with your own work along the same lines, or something they said that puzzled you that you just want a little bit of clarification on. We'll try to reserve a few minutes at the end for larger big think questions. Could be from anybody in the room, or Carolyn, if there's any questions from abroad, that would be fine. Yeah, go ahead.
It was really, really hard. And what we did is, when I was talking about the learning outcomes, we took the learning outcomes from 3-credit hour or 4-credit hour syllabi, and on the back end, the students don't have to concern themselves with this, but on the back end, we map our competencies to the learning outcomes, and so the student is working through competencies and showing competencies, but we have a shadow transcript that they'll get at the end that shows the credit hours, and there's all kinds of Department of Education and federal aid requirements that would have us do that, but the student doesn't have to concern him or herself with that.
Is online preparation for? Yeah. If you could restate her question for the online.
Right. Well, interestingly, I mean, this is half answering your question, then I'll answer it a little bit. But we're looking at a lot of partnerships with Georgia Virtual High Schools and students that are actually familiar with that experience already, and there's quite a lot out there that at least in Georgia, is actually quite far ahead in terms of online delivery at the high school level. But there hasn't been a clear baccalaureate path for them. As far as preparation, I agree that's something that the Columbus team would be looking into, and I can follow up with more on that. No answer at this point.
In fact, there may be a number of answers like that. These are pioneers, and they're pioneers largely in the dark here, really trying to sort of find their way. And so, I mean, it will be really interesting. One of the things that we have tried to be very clear about with them is that, you know, our support for them is designed to help their initiative move forward, but it's also to help the entire field move forward. And so, you know, the content products that come out of their experience are going to be very blunt, and you'll learn exactly what they learned, both positive and negative and everything in between. You know, that's the whole point of this whole initiative. So stay tuned for a complete answer to that question. Okay, so let's go to the next of our domains. This one has to do with methods and how they are designing and implementing a program that can hold all of these goals that you just heard about.
So once you know what outcomes you need to reach, it's possible to begin developing the pathway to get there and also to put students onto that pathway. So that's designing and implementing these two framework components. For an institution designing a new degree program, that means looking at the way things will work for students and also the way they'll work from the perspective of the institution. So looking across both of those two perspectives. The common themes with methods here are shown from a student's perspective, a student's eye view of what design and implementation could look like in a breakthrough program. The student can engage with the work because it seems like a fit. It seems like it matches his or her own way of learning, his or her own life goals, his or her own best ways of learning. The student is aware of where they stand at any given time. They can look at exactly the same information that faculty, that student support staff have. They can all be on the same page, and they can all act quickly on that information. And the student has clear, continually available ways to get help if they're struggling. So that's the way it looks from the point of view of a student. How does a next generation design appear from the perspective of the breakthrough model institution? What needs to change in order to implement a program like this that will meet student needs? I think most of us in this room working in institutions can clearly see things would need to change in order for some of these things to happen. The questions you've already been asking get at some of those aspects. So, for instance, the way that the faculty and the professional staff of an institution divide up the work would be different. The way that the institution allocates funding among the different components of its expenses is going to change. If you need additional student support staff and you need to train those staff differently, then you probably are going to need to rethink your budget. To make the cost dramatically more affordable, the tuition models will probably have to be rethought. So, for instance, several of our models have a pay-as-you-go program in which you pay a particular amount for a set period of time and then can take more or fewer courses within that depending on the progress that you make. So Art and Allison, let me invite you to share some specific examples of how the methods are working at your institutions.
I chose to talk about designing feedback at both the student level and the institutional or assessment level. And the first piece of advice that I have is different than when we started. And the first piece of advice is make really good friends with your IT departments and learn how to talk to analysts really well, your analysts really well, because they're invaluable. And what we did for students, and we have our first students this spring, and so we hope that it works, is in those degree paths that I mentioned when I first spoke with you, is every single unit of learning is represented in a student dashboard, but not all at once, as the student needs that. And the student will know in every single assignment, something that we send them out to the community to do, anything the student does, they will have immediate feedback, not just technologically, but also from one of the faculty roles that we've created. And so the student knows exactly where he or she stands. And we think that that's really, really important, because the student doesn't have to wait till midterm, for instance, to know. It's at a very small level of learning. And we couldn't do that without technology. They also have the capability through social spaces to know how their peers are doing, who are working on maybe the same sort of topic, and so they can talk with each other. So there's lots of support that's both flesh and blood and technological. So the student knows where he or she stands, but the institution can see a broader dashboard. And so the lead faculty, who are assigned to majors, not to students, but to a major degree path, know where in the degree path students are doing well, that is learning things quickly, but also learning things deeply, and they can know where there's something that students just aren't getting. And so in real time, and here's where you have to be friends with your IT department, they can go in and change that component to make it better, and it cascades across every piece in any degree path where that is important. And so they can do real-time, error-free corrections to these online learning instruments. And so, again, we're being brief, but those are two areas where we do a sort of feedback loop, one for the student and one for the institution.
From the student perspective, the previous slide talked about setting high expectations. And there's a lot of talk about three-year bachelor's degrees out there, and in some cases it's an advertising gimmick. But in other cases, like we saw from Professor Tinto this morning, is that setting high expectations, or setting just the expectations that you set, matters, because right now we're reporting on six-year graduation rates. All of a sudden, a four-year degree became a six-year degree. So we're looking at, if we take this idea and say, we're going to make a promise to you that structurally everything's going to be in place, that you will be able to graduate in 3 years. It's not going to be something that we're going to do to you or mess up on your scheduling on your end, but we're going to show you the path to graduate in 3 years, and that's going to be the expectation for this program. Then that's something new and different that we haven't done in the system, and that's what the student method that we're taking in this case. As part of that, there's also intermediary markers of achievement. They're going to achieve a certificate in the first year, associate's degree in the second, bachelor's in the third, which is interesting for Georgia, too, because we're lacking a traditional community college system. And so the value of an associate's degree is actually something that employers don't know a lot about in Georgia, and that or can't quite understand kind of what's coming out. And our faculty as well, and advisors and students, don't understand necessarily the benefit of having that marker, or what you learn differently in an associate's degree versus a bachelor's degree in that transition. Back to your point about online education, too, the method that we're employing here is partially competency-based, about a third. Then two-thirds are going to be in a cohort method. It's not that you can't necessarily do cohort method in a competency-based format, but it hasn't quite been meshed together right. And there's a lot of value in students coming together and doing that progression as a group. And you see that a lot with MOOCs now, too, that the providers of some of the MOOCs will tell you that there's a lot of benefit to having certain start and stop times, and that it generates that sense of learning community. So we're looking at this idea of how do we pull out pieces that may be more appropriate to deliver in a competence-based format, and then how do you combine that with something that may be delivered in a more traditional cohort-based format.
Right. Thank you both. So other quick clarifying questions on this portion, methods, designing, and implementing? Over. Back right? Oh, sorry, way back there. Speak up. Yeah, they're available right now on the ELI conference website. So if you go to this session in the agenda.
Could you repeat the question for us, please?
Yes. Sorry. The question was, can everybody listening to this have access to this set of slides with the links that are embedded in them? And yes, this deck is available right now on the ELI conference website. Just go to this particular session, and you'll find your way to it. Thanks. Okay, so let's go to the last of our domains. This is environments. This is the water that we're swimming in. And for these two in different ways, you know, an entirely new division of personalized learning, you know, and a fairly complex collaboration between a state university system and a community college and lots of policy landscape challenges to deal with. So let's reverse the order here and have Art come up after Nancy takes you through a few of our overarching themes that we're seeing across the grantees.
So I have many, many notes about this subject just because it's one where so many changes in the landscape are coming to bear right now is this area of policy and environmental conditions, and so much is changing. All of us in this room are aware of the wrangling that's going on today with as higher education faces the environment in which things are so rapidly changing and there's so much more potential access for students, even as student success rates are not, as our first speaker today said, improving at the same degree. So there's badging, there's other credentialing programs. How are they going to be viewed in the real world? What should institutions be doing about those? How are institutions going to deal with student participation in MOOCs? What will the DOE decide to do about competency-based programs? What will accreditors do about competency-based programs? When there's so much abundance of resources, how does that translate into the ways universities have traditionally acted in a scarce resources environment where everything was carefully bounded and guarded? What happens in the age of Google to the library? And all those other questions that we address at meetings like ELI and at EDUCAUSE and many other gatherings. So some of the common themes among our grantees. This is one in which the breakthrough models really have the charge and the capacity not just to break through, but really to blaze a trail so that other institutions can also adopt some of these new pathways. We can't have one of the reasons that this whole area of our grant making began was that there were about three models out there that anyone could point to that were being done differently. And what we're really hoping to do is increase that by a factor of four with these grantees that are here with us today and their eight colleague grantees in the Breakthrough Models portfolio. So they're looking at how they're going to incorporate open educational resources. They're looking at and having direct impact on how the state bodies across the country will operate in this new era. Three of these grantees, including Georgia, are at the state level. And they're working with their accreditors and probably sitting in on some meetings with the Department of Education now and again to talk about that whole area of how programs are accredited and how the credit hour fares in an era 100 years after it was come up with as the one way to measure learning. In a spirit of access first and pay later, one of our grantees is working specifically with MOOCs in the delivery of their breakthrough program. So Art and Allison, over to you.
This is one of my favorite because I'm the faceless bureaucrat that sits downtown in a beautiful, boring state office building. Well, on the other two, my colleagues down at the campus level are doing the actual hard work. But there's a lot. When we first got this opportunity, we said, you know, we typically don't go after opportunities that a campus could do themselves. But this was such a big challenge that we're talking about. And indeed, we see it in the other grantees that it takes kind of a system level approach to work with a lot of this because you're changing a lot of new things. One very simple example, we've been going to the Board of Regents, our governing board in the state, for forever raising tuition. In this next month, we're going to go and ask to lower it in this program. And it's, I think, the very first time we've ever done that. And it's causing some confusion just because it's, okay, what's going on here? If you have a new way of doing things, why aren't we doing this everywhere? Like, okay, give us a chance to prove it. It's still a proof of concept phase, but I think when you're making this whole scale change, especially at the system level like that, you can see these promised outcomes and say, okay, we should be doing these everywhere. Like, let's take it at pace. Let's work with the evaluators, make sure the student learning is quality in this case, and then scale that elsewhere. And that's exactly our intention with this grant, too, is to look at support the work that's going on with Columbus State, but through the use of specifically open educational resources, through the use of developing these competency-based modules, through the use of looking at different support systems, see where we can borrow that and apply that elsewhere to our other 30 other institutions or to other degree programs, and really use Columbus State as a test bed and a learning base for this. But it gets to this whole point where we're having interesting communications issues of how do you talk about these new models, especially in terms of affordability. And when you throw out fees, how do you talk about the total cost to students? And even just comparing per credit hour, is per credit hour even the right metric? In this case, it's not necessarily. And then how do you talk about assurance of student success? Because there's metrics that we've all committed to in terms of graduation rates for this, and they're higher than any of our existing programs for incoming students of that same level. And that, so we're looking at things at what's the difference to student cost in terms of both opportunity cost and likelihood of success, and trying to figure out a different way to communicate the value of pathways beyond just it's going to cost you X much per semester, because that's just not going to work. But it takes a little nuanced communication, especially at the state and even federal level now, of what this means in terms of affordability to students with these new models.
When a unit is given permission, or in this case created, to do something so new and we think exciting, there's a lot of responsibility that comes with that. And because we're also offering a very low tuition rate, one of the responsibilities is to make sure that we don't lose money for the institution. In fact, it would be good if we could make money for the institution. And so how do we keep our first goal, which is to have a very high quality program, but then be able to do these new innovative things? And so scale is what I want to talk about. And we looked at this primarily, of course, as an educational endeavor, but we also looked at it as a software project or an IT project. And so we asked ourselves, in every case, we ask, how does this impact students? How will we message this to our internal and external constituencies? And how do we scale it? And so we have constructed everything that we've constructed so that at the topic level, for instance, we can scale the topic. At the degree path level, we can scale degree. So once we launch our first three majors, we are ready to start building out new majors. The same system that we've put in place scales. And it's the design of the software that allows that. And remember, advice, make friends with your IT department. It's really important to have people who can do that for you. And so scale is very, very important, that you're able to grow the program. But that's politically important, too, because when you start, you have to work with a small group per force. But then you want to spread to the university in a larger way, and so you want to be able to offer them something that's not this pioneering in the dark kind of work that Art mentioned. One way to scale that's not technological is the use of open source, and I'll be brief here, but if we're going to be inexpensive and affordable for our students, then there has to be a way to get quality materials to them that are current and that we know are good. And open source is invaluable in this respect. So we've built into every QA process for every part of the degree that wherever it's finished, then you add one more open source way of learning. And so that's a place to enrich the experience for the student. It broadens things, it makes things current, and it's also usually without cost, except for the implementation cost.
Great, thank you. So quick clarifying questions on the environments domain. Anybody who's trying to do similar sorts of work and coming up against policy or regulatory constraints that are making that difficult? Yeah.
Hi, I was just wondering what kinds of conversations you've had with your accrediting organizations and what have their responses been toward your competency-based models?
We're in SACS, of course, and some of the earlier conversations, like direct assessment, of course, has been taking up place up north. So I think those conversations were a little bit behind, and to be honest, and we're looking at that now, and in progress, and that's all I can say on that. One of the interesting things too, though, is even though within our own system, you know, we've set the requirements that among all of our 31 institutions, the entire core curriculum, about 42 hours, is transferable from institution to institution as long as you meet certain grade requirements, so you're admitted to that institution. So even within our own system, we're looking at how do we stay honest in terms of mapping, say, competencies back to courses so that a student who may need for life circumstances to transfer or wish to transfer a different program has a place to go to, so we're not breaking a policy that we set ourselves that we think is really important for that transferability. So both internally and externally, we're looking at that and working on that, but no updates so far as to SACS.
Northern Arizona University is accredited through HLC, and they've been working with us, and we're happy that that's a collegial process. It's we're at a stage right now where the Department of Education with HLC has said that what we're doing is direct assessment, and they're creating a protocol for us and a few other institutions. And I can't say much more than that either. We're sort of waiting, but we're hopeful, and we've passed a screening stage.
One of our other grantees in this portfolio, Southern New Hampshire University, is accredited and is perhaps the second after Western Governors to have done so. And they were asked similar questions at a previous session at the EDUCAUSE annual conference. You can find that, a link to that webinar, I mean that presentation on our website, and you might benefit from watching that and seeing their experience in getting accredited for this kind of program. So I'm looking out at you over the course of these 45 minutes, and I've seen this sort of wash of different kinds of expressions, you know, and they go from, you know, sort of this cocked eyebrow, really? You know, you're going to your state legislators to ask for less money. Huh, this is new, you know, for all of us. You know, to other kinds of expressions that are okay, you know, call us when you've actually accomplished all this. As we said before, you know, these folks are either in the first year or in the planning year for these kinds of models that are really questioning everything about the goals, the way you measure them, the design of the learning, the design of the execution, and the way the operations support that, and the ways that initiative intersects with the environmental landscape that it is part of. It's just terrifically courageous work. I regret that we don't have another hour here to ask you all to come up and talk about the kinds of work that you're doing yourselves that echo a lot of what is going on here, because the fact that you're in the room means that you're doing it, or at least thinking hard about it. And everyone in here deserves an awful lot of credit for that. So thank you.
A badge, right? Everybody should get a
badge. A badge, right. And on the way to your badge, and while you are working on your own initiatives, keep an eye cocked towards nextgenlearning.org, because beginning last fall, under the leadership of Kristen Vogt down here, waving her arm, our knowledge management officer, we've started throwing off a lot of content coming out of the collective experience of our grantees. That includes practice documentation. There are profiles there. There are videos there. There are the original PowerPoint decks that they submitted as part of their applications that are pretty thoughtful documents about the vision that they wanted to pursue. There are analyses that follow trends across the different grantees. There's an emerging set of toolkits that will hopefully, you know, if some of you are ready to launch an effort to envision something like this, The idea behind these toolkits is to save you 6 months of research, you know, and collecting of stuff and figuring out how to organize the conversation that you want to have. So our goal with this initiative is to convert, you know, all of their skinned knees, you know, and everything that they're encountering into practical tools and resources that will help you do the same kind of work and forge your own pathway, because all these models will be different from each other in order for them to suit your own local circumstances. So unless there's anything else, I think we're sort of at the end of the session. Again, this PowerPoint is online at the reference to this session on the ELI conference website. You can find us, Nancy and me, at nextgenlearning.org, A. Calkins and N. Millichap. And before we let you go, two small pieces of homework. One is to go to this URL and evaluate this session. That would really help. You will earn a badge, Yelp style, as a reviewer for the quality of content that you encountered here. We welcome you to come on up and talk to these folks, and Nancy and I are happy to talk with you about other grantees in the portfolio. Michelle Diaz, another member of our staff, is back there waving her hand. If you have an extra minute to spare and want to respond to a three-question survey she's doing this week about the design of our website and how we can organize these resources so that they will be most efficiently provided to you, we would really love that. So on behalf of us, thank you all for coming. Really appreciate it, and have a great rest of your day and conference. Thanks.